Good morning. You're listening to WITF 89.5, and this is Radio Smart Talk, Coping with the Economy, a WITF News special. It's in response to the current economic climate in the mid-state, across the country, and across the world, and in response to your feedback about the economic situation that we're launching this temporary special program.
That's how it sounded 10 years ago this week, on October 9th, 2008, as WITF launched what was then called Radio Smart Talk. The nation was at the height of what became known as the Great Recession, the worst economic downturn since the Great Depression in the 1930s. The Dow Jones Industrial Average had lost 1,200 points the day before, actually on this day in 2008. 478,000 people filed for jobless claims the week before. Banks weren't lending money, and some were going out of business. All this week, we'll be looking back at what's happened over the last 10 years on Smart Talk. That voice you heard was the Smart Talk's Smart Talk's very first host, news director at WITF at the time, Scott Gilbert. And Scott Gilbert joins me this morning. Scott, how are you?
I'm great, Scott. Thanks for having me back in the studio.
You haven't aged a day.
That's kind of you, but I don't know if that's true.
Well, I think I've seen you since then. But let's go back to, before we talk about the program, let's go back to the economic conditions of the nation at the time. What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember all the questions on people's minds, right? Because we were in unprecedented territory for so many people across the country. You know, we've all seen the stock market go up by a couple hundred points, maybe down by a few hundred. But to see what was happening with the stock market and all the questions that triggered about, what's going to happen to my kids' 529 accounts? What's happening to my retirement plan? What should I do with my money? I remember that people were in, various levels of panic, and they had these questions that, again, ultimately this show was founded to help answer.
Well, let's talk about that. The planning of the program came together in just a few days, maybe even a day. I know that it was on the minds.
22 hours, he's counting. Yeah.
It was on the minds of a lot of people here at WITF, but did come to fruition in less than 24 hours. What do you remember about planning for Radio Smart Talk at that time?
I remember one morning around 10:30 or so, getting a call from Joyce Davis, who at the time was our vice president of content, and she said, "Could you come down to my office?" I said, "Sure." So I go down the hallway, I walk in, and I see Joyce, but I also see Mitzi, our director of radio, and Craig, who is our program director at the time, and I'm like, okay, this might not be good, because I had no idea what the meeting was about. And you walk in, you see three higher-ups, you're like, all right, where's my box? But it ended up being nothing like that, of course. Basically, it was explained to me. As you know, Scott, we've been in a dialogue around here about what can we do to answer questions people have. How can we fill the void on this important topic? And we've decided we're going to start a daily one-hour talk show devoted to this. And I said, that sounds like a great idea. They said, we'd like you to host it, at least at the onset. Would you consider that? I said, absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things you don't have to think about because you realize the gravity of the opportunity. It sounds like it's a great idea. I said, sounds great. Are we talking about maybe next week? Are we going to start this in a few days? And Mitzi looks at me and says, we're starting the show tomorrow. And that set into play this amazing process. I feel like the way I remember it is from all reaches of the organization. I mean, you had people in sales helping us find those first two guests, Rick and Scott. You have people in programming, of course, pulling together all the elements you need for a talk show. You have engineering swinging into action to get the phone bank in place, because we didn't have a phone bank in the studio, but in the course of a few hours, we did. And the next morning, we were on the air at 9 a.m. with Radio Smart Talk.
Well, radio is supposed to be and is designed to be immediate, and that's a perfect example of it being just that. But also, I think it's also an example of WITF responding to the community.
Yep, definitely.
It was such a national story. Actually, an international story, because it wasn't just the United States that was in the throes of this economic downturn. But, the NPR was covering it every single day. We were hearing so much about it. But as you described, so many people here in central Pennsylvania wanted to talk about it because they were being impacted or could be impacted by it. So this was our way of engaging the public. You mentioned Scott and Rick. Scott Eric, who was with M&T Bank at that time, and Rick Rogers of Rick Rogers & Associates, and both will be on the program a little bit later. We'll talk about 2008 and how the economy has changed over the last 10 years. I actually was in a state college that day doing an interview. I got a phone call. Came back and was told, okay, we're having a meeting in about a half hour because we're doing a radio talk show the next day. And I had hosted a talk show before, so I was producing the program.
Right.
One thing I'd like to ask, and there may be people who have just tuned in over the last few years, why was it called Radio Smart Talk?
Well, because we had a Smart Talk on TV at the time, right? It was hosted by Nell McCormick Abom, and so we thought that it would be, you know, that show had great name recognition, and we thought it would be great to create to use that name on the radio side of things. But of course, we had to differentiate it. So we talked, do we call it Smart Talk Radio or do we call it Radio Smart Talk? I think those were like the only two names on the board there. And we took a quick vote, and it was pretty unanimous. We went Radio Smart Talk.
And it is Smart Talk today.
Yeah.
So one final question, Scott. And I'm asking you to try to drum up a memory from 10 years ago. But what did you want to do with the program, that first discussion and the subsequent discussions about the economy over the weeks?
Well, like you said, I mean, NPR was covering this subject matter pretty thoroughly, right? So I think the challenge for us locally, both in our news product, because at the time I was news director, but also with this new program, was to figure out how could we contribute to the dialogue locally? How could we add to and not duplicate what NPR was doing? And I think you hit on it. I mean, it was all about engaging the community. And I think that was my biggest hope, was creating an opportunity for interaction, because it is very useful to provide people with information, but I think it goes a step further to give them an opportunity to engage, to call in, to send emails, to ask questions via social media. And it's awesome to see what you've done with it over the last 10 years or so, where and how it just is it's all about engagement today, right? I mean, where you're taking the show on the road now, what, about once a month, right?
Yes.
And so, I mean, to see what has become of this program in terms of truly engaging the community and providing meaningful civil discourse at a time where it seems like that's harder than ever to come by, I think that's really something. That's really special. And there's no other hour on the media like this anywhere else in central Pennsylvania. And so I think, to answer your question, you know, I think it goes back to the fact that in those first days, you know, we really wanted to complement and not duplicate what was happening nationally. I think we accomplished that early on, but it's really great to see what the show's become.
Scott, thank you very much for being with us, good friend. And by the way, we should mention, because we're going to talk about what everyone has done over the last 10 years. You're no longer with WITF, Penn State Hershey now, and in the communications department, where you do a fabulous job.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott. Yeah, I work with a lot of great people at Penn State Health and Penn State College of Medicine. I'm a team lead for public relations and multimedia. So my team handles media relations, social media, photography, and videography. It's a lot of fun and a great place.
Thanks for all your contributions, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
And now we're joined by Scott Eric, who was with M&T Bank at the time and now with FMA Advisory, and Rick Rogers of Rogers & Associates Financial Planners. Gentlemen, thank you for being with us in 2008 and for joining us again today, 10 years later. Thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be back.
Good morning, Scott. You haven't aged a day.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Rick, I'll start with you. Let's go back to October 2008. What do you remember about that time?
Well, the time that we did that broadcast, it was just 3 weeks after the Lehman Brothers bankruptcy, which many point to as the beginning of this crisis. But in fact, the market had peaked in October of the year before, and we were already down 4,700 points. So we were down over 30%. We were in bear market territory. And as these things are always scary, they're scary for clients, they're scary for advisors. Some of my advisors had not even been in through a downturn before. The tech wreck ended in 2002. And so And that was a very different different kind of decline. This was much more severe and in a shorter period of time. And so the days then were just beginning of spending most of the time on the phone trying to talk people into not panicking, because it was very easy to want to panic and sell everything and wait this out.
Scott?
I agree with Rick completely. Our job as advisors is to keep a steady hand on the tiller. And it's moments like that, either euphoria or despair in this case, where people make the biggest mistakes in their personal finances. I remember watching this with a fascination and a terrifying perspective as a finance pro, because Lehman Brothers' collapse was neither the beginning nor the end of the financial crisis. It had been building for some time. As early as 5 months prior, J.P. Morgan stepped in to take over Bear Stearns, and that was facilitated by the Fed. J.P. was a willing partner, but the Fed guaranteed the debt that they took on in order to make it happen. Even the week before Lehman Brothers failed, Fannie and Freddie had to be taken over into conservatorship, which exists to this day, even though it was supposed to be a temporary mechanism. And then the weekend of, Friday, September 12th, Tim Geithner calls Hank Paulson and said, Lehman's not going to be
Treasury Secretary.
Yes. Yeah, so Geithner was the president of the New York Fed at the time, and he called Paulson and said, we've got to find a dance partner, do something to save Lehman, because they won't be able to open on Monday. And they worked the phones along with Ben Bernanke all weekend, and they couldn't find a dance partner. Barclays was teed up and walked away Sunday evening and said, we just can't touch these guys because they're levered 30-1. And it didn't help that Dick Fuld, who was the chairman of Lehman Brothers, he was the only guy back in 1998, and Rick and I both remember this, the long-term capital crisis. Wall Street got together and bailed out long-term capital, except for Lehman Brothers, and Dick Fuld was in charge at the time. So he didn't have a whole lot of friends, and it's hard to find a date for the prom.
Well, okay, this was not just a Wall Street issue. I mean, the things you point to were kind of like the dominoes falling in place. I mean, this all started, and now we have 10 years of history that we can look back on, with subprime mortgages that many banks and institutions made loans to people who couldn't afford them. And then there would be other institutions who would take on that debt.
Yes.
Explain, if you would, Scott, how that led to those dominoes falling.
It's interesting, because when you roll back the attribution and the tape, if you will, to see what was really going on, it's almost like a Tom Clancy mystery novel or spy thriller, where it's seemingly unrelated events and decisions kind of coalesce or get woven together into the narrative of the time. And so if you look back, there was an obscure opinion by an S&P analyst, a rating agency analyst, who decided that, and he wrote this publicly and later recanted it, that if people take out a second mortgage right on top of their first mortgage to avoid the PMI insurance, okay, they instantly go into greater debt to avoid that monthly payment, it presented no greater risk profile with respect to the credit. That was published, and that became the basis, honestly, for a flawed rating system that rated mortgages on the same scale as corporate debt. He later recanted, but the cat was out of the, or the horse was out of the barn at that point. And so what happened was you had rating agencies competing with each other to rate these exotic securities, these derivatives, where they could make premium fees, not the plain vanilla mortgages where they had base fees, but Moody's and Standard & Poor's liked these complex things because they could make more money, but the investment banks knew it. They would shop. Goldman would go to Moody's and say, how much garbage can we put in this particular synthetic vehicle, this derivative, and still get a AA rating or an A rating? And they would play them off against Standard & Poor's. Well, they'll let us put 8% in, and you're only going to give us 7. So the rating agencies were, in effect, complicit, and they are now regulated more heavily. So people were buying these things with ratings that were not really appropriate. You combine that fact with basically a policy driven from Washington to drive home ownership, and it's not really fair to blame the Clinton administration, although they articulated it. They wanted to take home ownership in the United States from 60% up to 70%. And it was very expedient for both parties to define success and the American dream in terms of home ownership. So then you had financial institutions extending credit to folks who maybe shouldn't have been getting loans in the first place.
We have an email from Thomas who says, just a comment, if those living in 2008 when this happened just kept their head and didn't act on emotion, they would have made up for all their losses. I was buying when others were selling, and in that period of time, I became a millionaire by investing in the stock market and real estate. Some of my stocks went up over 2,000%. Panic does not help in a period of time like that. Rick, that was similar to what you were saying earlier.
Yes, it's an important part of the business cycle, and it's not fun to go through, but we need to go through these periods where we purge out the bad apples, and that's what 2008-2009 was. But when you're going through it, it's easy to fall into, this time it's different. This time it's going to be worse.
But it
this
was
time,
different.
The actual events, the things that happened were different, but the results were the same. We had a downturn, and our economy is incredibly resilient. It recovered. It recovered a lot faster than what people were saying back in October of 2008. The consumer assets were somewhere around $83-84 trillion in October of 2007, which was the peak of the market. And today they're $122 trillion. So not only did they recover, but we're now almost 50% higher than what we were just 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Scott Eric, who was with M&T Bank in 2008 and now is with FMA Advisory, and Rick Rogers of Rick Rogers & Associates Financial Planners. We're talking about October 2008, what's transpired over the last 10 years since Smart Talk debuted on October 9th, 2008. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. UITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Right, so what I want to get into is how people on the street, if you will, were impacted by what did happen in 2008. We know that once it was determined that many people could not afford some of these exotic mortgages that they had, that there were a lot of people who lost their homes. Foreclosures were rampant. There were banks that were closing. There were banks that weren't lending money. To this day, I think the probably credit is a little bit tighter. But for the individual person out there, it was a scary time, Rick.
Oh,
and
yes.
People looked at it and said, okay, we're hearing comparisons to the Great Depression of the 1930s that this could get worse. I don't know how people could not have, I don't know if panicked is the word, but reacted in some way.
Yeah, unfortunately, and I think Warren Buffett used this term, so I'm going to give him credit, although I'm not 100% sure. He called it a negative feedback loop, because what was happening in October of 2008 was bad news. You'd hear bad news, which would cause people to react to that bad news, which might be, oh, I could lose my job, so I'm not going to go through with purchasing a car. I'm not going to make any big purchases. We're going to cut back. And so I'm cutting back on my spending. Many other consumers cut back on their spending. Businesses reacted to that. Look at this contraction. Consumers aren't going to, so we're going to lay people off, which then got reported as more layoffs. People then become more scared because, oh, geez, I might lose my job. I need to cut back even further. And so bad news led to people reacting, making things actually worse, and this negative feedback loop continued until it finally ended. Now, in October of 2008, we didn't see where the bottom was, and when the bottom actually happened in March of 2009, there weren't any signs that went off. CNBC didn't come out and say, okay, it's over. We still didn't know. You have to be able to look back and see, okay, now things are getting better, and I think the financial press like to use the term green shoots. We see these green shoots, and as more green shoots, more positive things were happening, then we started climbing back out of it. But as you're going through it, it definitely is scary, and it's hard not to react to it. But the person who emailed in, it's a time where we can either lose a lot of money or we can make a lot of money, and we need to keep remembering that we've been through these things before. The details may be different this time, but the end result is going to be that business will survive, not all of them, which is why we diversify, but businesses survive and they recover, and now we're at, 3.7% unemployment, 20-year low?
Actually, the lowest since 1969.
Oh, even longer.
So Rick makes a couple of great points there. It is about confidence, whether it's individuals making spending decisions. But back in that time, there was tremendous lack of confidence in the stability of the financial system. That's where it was really different. It wasn't isolated like long-term capital. There was a grave danger that the global financial system was freezing up. And that's what was so scary about it. When we think about he also made a great point about diversification. That was one of the underlying themes that led to this problem. Really, people were scared because now it was mortgages, and these vehicles were built on the idea that if you spread risk across multiple mortgages, everything will be okay because you don't have too much in one basket or one asset. But the entire class of investments were flawed, and there were obviously very sketchy underwriting standards with no income, the ninja loans, no income, no job. People were still getting loans, and so they infected the entire system. That's what was so scary about it. And when we think about where we've come since then, it's fascinating because there are still some of the same issues at play. Many of those things have been worked out of the system. When we think about home ownership, 9 million people were forced out of their homes at that point in time. And you're right, Scott, underwriting standards are higher now. But still, there are loans being made again today that are requiring probably too little cash down and terms that are probably a little bit too loose. We're basically getting back into the same sort of circumstance, not to the same degree. Banks are better capitalized than they were, and there's a stronger regulatory structure in place. But people are still people, and they want to have their homes, and they want higher interest rates and yields on their investments. And so we see the seeds being planted, not for the same sort of crisis. We don't know what the contours are going to look like today of the next crisis, but it'll probably have to do with property values and borrowing against them because that's the way the system is set up.
But something that Rick mentioned that is very important is that that loss of consumer confidence, and that there were many Americans, millions of Americans, who decided that I'm not confident that I will keep my job. The figure that I used, 159,000 people filed jobless claims the month before in September of 2008, that 70% of our economy is driven by consumer spending. That, we can talk about the stock market, we can talk about investments, we can talk about mortgages, all those things, but consumer spending is what drives this economy. And without that, that's how we go into a recession. One of the things that was unique about this recession, I'm going to get eventually to what brought us out of it, how we did recover, but one of the things that was unique about this recession and the recovery is how slow it was to come back. As you said, Rick, March 2009 was the bottom, but jobs did not return. Employment did not return for a long, long time. And many of those same experts that you talk about kept scratching their heads saying, okay, why is this not recovering? Why are the employers not adding jobs? They also were somewhat frightened or scared off a little bit that the recovery was being made. All right, there's a lot there. But let's start with, and I should add that one of the things that the federal government did respond with was stimulus money that tried to get, especially in infrastructure. There was this great plan to create jobs in building highways and infrastructure. Some of the largest companies in the country were, as referred to, described as bailed out. I mean, the automobile industry, AIG, the insurance giant. So that's kind of the background, the context for where we are. Rick, I'll ask you first. Scott, then I'll ask you your opinion then. What got the country and really the world out of the recession?
I think that there was a big reluctance among employers to make any changes in 2009, even into 2010, because of uncertainty about regulation. The government wanted to do something about this crisis that happened, and so we eventually got a financial bill that was through, and so banks were not lending or were very reluctant to lend because they didn't know what the new rules were going to be. And then when the rules came out, then they weren't sure how they were going to be implemented. So businesses didn't have access to capital. There was also the Obamacare Act that went through in 2010, which employers were concerned about, how is this going to impact me? What am I going to have to pay my employees? What am I going to have to provide my employees? So there was a reluctance to hiring.
And they knew it ahead of time. Yes. They knew it was coming. Right. So that's it wasn't just 2010.
So there was a lot of things that really made employers hesitate to add people. And if you recall that when they did start adding, there was a lot of temporary and part-time workers that were put in until we were sure that things were actually going this way and rules were going to be handled this way. So could that have speeded things up? Probably.
I would agree with much of what Rick said. And it's pretty clear that uncertainty and lack of confidence drives decision making. And so when you think about the executives of large companies and even smaller ones, they had just seen their capital destroyed. Okay, they've seen their stock prices decimated, and they want to recover their profits. So they were able to increase output by putting more into technology, and there were significant productivity gains after that. So companies were able to do more with less, and they put off those hiring decisions, as Rick mentioned, because they knew that they were going to have to pay for more insurance if someone was working more than 30 or 32 hours a week. And so one of my favorite maxims, a former colleague of mine came up with it, the game is played in accordance with how the score is kept. And when there's uncertainty regarding regulation and things like that, it does make executives a bit more trepidatious in terms of making that investment in hiring people back. But it's rational to expect that they will not hire anybody unless they know that there's demand for bringing that extra person on to increase one more unit of their output. And so they delayed that decision as long as they possibly could.
So we only have a few minutes left, but what ultimately, and I'm sure there's not just one thing, but what ultimately started the recovery and brought the nation and the world, you know, something we really haven't talked about is that right. There were some real, I remember Absolutely. Saying to the two of you at the time that were over the years that I was paying attention to what was happening in Japan and China for the first time in my life because there was an impact here in the United States. But what ultimately happened to bring us out of that recession and for the economy to recover?
The Fed successfully backstopped the system. Okay, and so people finally believed that the bottom was in. And like Rick said, there's no flashing signal that says that, but they implemented a number of things, regulatory reform, some of which really took a long time to put in place, but the Dodd-Frank Act of 2010, and really enhanced powers for regulators, increasing the capital ratios for banks. And you're right, Scott, it's a global thing. We've seen Tier 1 capital, core capital in U.S. financial institutions go up by a third from 9.8% pre-crisis to 12.9% today. And in Europe, it was even more pronounced. It's up two-thirds from 8.8% to 14.7%. In downturns, equity hurts, but debt kills. And there's been a reevaluation of how companies fund themselves.
Rick, are we prepared to, if there's a recession, and we know there eventually will be another recession, but one that, are we prepared at this point that it will not be as serious, it will not be the bottom dropping out like 2007, 2008?
Well, I wish I could say that, but history has a habit of repeating itself, and that certainly is true of economic cycles. Talk about consumer being 70% of our economy. There's also a statistic that seems to be pretty consistent that 75% of our consumers live paycheck to paycheck. And we get real serious about getting our finances in order when we have a 2008-09 event. Consumers cut back on their debt. They started living within their means. And at this point, 10 years later, consumers have not begun to take on debt again. The debt level for consumers has remained pretty constant. And actually, the amount of mortgages outstanding has returned to what it was in 2007. So the mortgage balance now has returned to where it was. My advice to your viewers would be learn to get your spending in check, because when these things happen, you don't want to have debt. you want, just like Scott said, it's debt that ruins us, and debt is fun to have when things are going well, but it's not fun to have when things go bad, and we never know when that's going to happen, so prepare now.
Debt is fun to have. That's how we can leave
because
it.
Because we can buy things. We can buy things
at any moment. I understand what you're saying. Yeah. I will use that, or my wife will probably use it when we make that purchase. Want to thank our guests for being with us today. And in 2008, October 2008, Rick Rogers of Rogers & Associates Financial Planners, Scott Eric is with FMA Advisory. Thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Pleasure's mine.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we continue WITF Smart Talk 10th anniversary. We talk about politics and what's happened over the past 10 years. You may have picked up on that when Scott Gilbert made the original introduction that this was supposed to be a temporary program dealing with the financial crisis. Well, if you remember 2008, what came up in November of 2008 was a pretty historic election when Barack Obama was elected president, and that's kind of how the program continued. So politics was a big part of Radio Smart Talk at the time and now Smart Talk. And so we'll be talking about politics tomorrow and 10 years of what's happened in politics, policy, and government over the past 10 years. Lead inspectors are warning that there are homes needed tested, but due to a recent change in how inspectors are paid, many go without. A state policy change has cut off the funding source that used to pay for lead inspections across Pennsylvania. We'll talk about its impact on this portion of today's program. Joining us, WITF Transforming Health reporter Brett Schultes, Lisa Allen, Executive Deputy Secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, and April Hutchison, Director of Communications with the Pennsylvania Department of Health. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at WITF. We're at Smart Talk WITF. That is at Smart Talk WITF. Again, the phone number 1-800-729-7532. Brett Schultes, you reported this story. Tell me about the genesis of it. How did it come about?
Well, I think that I was contacted by someone who didn't really end up in my story, who just was saying, hey, we have been doing this lead testing work for a long time, and now all of a sudden, because of a policy change, we are not able to get paid for a lot of the work we do. And just to be clear, this type of work is whenever a child tests positive for elevated blood lead levels, it really triggers a series of events that happen, including a home inspection, where a lead inspector will come in and work with the family, try to determine what might be the source of that lead. Could be anything from, you know, paint, old lead paint, to maybe even something like an item that they just have in their house. Could be an heirloom item. It could be makeup. It could be any number of things. And they try to pinpoint what that is because it's really integral that they get whatever that is out of there and stop the lead exposure for the child. And so that's how this all began for me.
So what did you find with the story?
Well, I found that the person who gave me that tip was correct, and I'm sure we can talk about that today. It's the Department of Human Services, beginning this year, changed the way that they administer the program. And it's not right to say that they've cut the funding off. Basically, they've sort of pulled their role out of it and said to the inspectors, you need to negotiate directly with the managed care organizations. And I'm going to try to not get too technical. But
in the weeds, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They basically said, you need to work directly with those who administer Medicaid to get reimbursed for the work that you do. And unfortunately, what's happened so far is that for a lot of those inspectors, the Medicaid administrators, the managed care organizations, haven't set up contracts with them. And so they're not able to get paid for their work. And meanwhile, a lot of the work throughout the state is being, for whatever reason, the managed care organizations have opted to partner or contract with pretty much one company called Accredited Environmental Technologies, which really has more of a history and bills itself as more of a and sort of real estate due diligence and environmental remediation, commercial industrial rather than, you know, residential.
One of the results of this is that there are fewer lead inspectors out there. Mary Lou Yingling is an inspector in York that you spoke with. Let's listen to what she had to say.
Ideally, we should go out at one blood lead level of 5 or greater. I can't do that just because of the caseload. I cannot get out to 200 children on my own.
Well, let's start with what she means by ideally five or more or less. Go ahead, April.
Sure. So I think there's a couple of things that we, you know, from an 100 feet perspective that's really important. And first is that, you know, lead is a serious issue in Pennsylvania. We have an aging housing market. We have a great industrial heritage, but those things have led to, you know, more lead exposure for children, pregnant women, you know, things like that. So it's really important that lead is a very serious issue in Pennsylvania, and we do take it very seriously. One of the things that we've called for is testing for all children under the age of 2 to make sure that we know exactly what they're being exposed to, because we only have small pockets right now of data and information. So,
okay, can I interrupt for a second?
Sure.
When you say small pockets, sounds almost hit or miss.
It is, actually. You know, of the eligible children in Pennsylvania, only about 28% are tested for lead. And one of the things that has been done is that the levels of lead, and kind of what you hear Mary Lou referring to, is that it used to be at a level of 10 microcuries per gram. It's been lowered. The standards have been lowered to 5. So we've actually gone back through from the Department of Health, from an epidemiological standpoint, and taken another look at all of the data across the state, and lowered that level to 5. We're getting ready to come out with our 2016-2017 lead report. But one of the things that has become very apparent, especially at from the 2015 report, is that we really don't have enough data to truly assess what it looks like across Pennsylvania. Some communities are, you know, and where in York, where Mary Lou is working, are very diligent in getting children tested. Some communities may not feel that it's an issue there. You know, if you live in new housing, it might not be, I'm not going to get my kid tested, for lead, but it might be in the soil because, you know, where you live may be have an industrial past that you may not know about. So those are some of the things that we're, you know, the administration's really been calling for is universal testing for all children under the age of 2, you know, not just by finger stick, but, you know, from actually drawing blood to get the most accurate information so that we can get a true picture of what this looks like across Pennsylvania.
Well, just to clarify, when the level has been reduced from 10 to 5, mm-hmm. that would say that more children would need to get tested.
Well, it would say that more children would be eligible for remediation as well. More housing, you know, would need to be remediated because of that. It's almost a perfect storm when you deal with lead, because the other thing that we have is cuts of funding to treat this problem.
From
the federal government. And that's where the source of funding has come from the Department of Health and the Department of Human Services, has really been through the federal government from Housing and Urban Development and from the CDC. Those funds are now disappearing. So we're trying to find ways to not only test, but to remediate using the resources we have.
So let me turn now to Lisa Allen, who's the Executive Deputy Secretary with the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services. Ms. Allen, when and why did the state decide to change how lead inspectors are reimbursed?
Yes, thank you, Scott. Back in January of 2017, we looked at what was happening across the Commonwealth with lead screening and follow-up care. And because almost 90% of the children that we serve are now served through the managed care delivery system, it made sense that not only was the requirement around the lead testing a requirement of the Medicaid managed care organizations, but the follow-up should also be part of that requirement. And so in January of 2017, we transitioned payment for environmental lead investigations from our fee-for-service delivery system to our medical assistance managed care organizations, partially because the providers who are performing the testing are part of the Medicaid managed care organizations networks at this point, and they really have the relationship with those providers and would be able to perform the follow-up care and give them the information around who should be doing the testing. So it made sense that we had a more coordinated approach across the delivery system for both the testing as well as the environmental lead investigations. Previously, the lead inspections under the fee-for-service system, those inspectors have had every opportunity to become enrolled in the managed care organizations networks. But under a managed care environment, they do have the freedom to build their networks based upon their business model, as long as it meets all the access requirements. And with the requirement now to from the CDC to test and actually have the identification at 5 deciliters or greater, this allows for additional testing and also for follow-up for those children. So a larger scale providers are probably well positioned to take on the higher volume of environmental lead investigations as providers become more aware of the recommendations for the service for those children at lower blood levels.
Well, I mean, I hear what you're saying. At the same time, you know, from what I hear from the actual inspectors, and it wasn't just one person in York, it was other inspectors in a lot of cities throughout the state, they did try to set up contracts with the managed care organizations, and for whatever reason, they were unable to do that. So I just don't think I agree with you whenever it comes to the idea that in reality, these larger companies are going to have greater, ability to roll this out over the state. You know, Accredited, for example, the company that seems to be getting all the contracts. They're based in, they have like offices in two counties, like Delaware and Fayette County. So I just would find it hard to believe that, and I don't know much else about them because unfortunately, so often this kind of pushing the responsibility out of the state's hands ends up leading to what's essentially like privatization. And, you can really look at a state agency and make sure that they're doing a good job. But when it comes to a private company like that, you know, they can deny my requests to talk, and that's pretty much it. So I don't really know what they're doing. You know, I can say that from city to city, the lead inspectors, these aren't people who are looking to just come in here and make a profit. They're not profit-oriented. Their interests aren't divided. They're not working on real estate development at the same time or big industrial projects. These are people who have been in this business, some of them for 20 or 30 years, and this all they care about is helping families that, because at the end of the day, what this is about is children who have lead in their blood and who need to be removed from those circumstances. So the fact that these people are being basically pushed out of the market to do this work because of just the policy change, I can't say that it looks like things are getting better. Despite all the talk of increased funding and efforts, legislative efforts, it seems like things are getting worse.
Well, Secretary Allen, what do you say to that?
Yeah, so the managed care organizations have chosen to contract with smaller, regionally based historic lead assessment organizations where it's beneficial for access or special conditions in the areas. For example, some of our managed care organizations in the southwest zone of Pennsylvania, which is in the Allegheny County area and the 10 surrounding counties, they also contract with the Allegheny Health Department. In addition to that, some of our managed care organizations in our Lehigh Capital area, which is Dauphin, Cumberland, Adams, they're contracting with Pinnacle, UPMC's lead entity that serves multiple counties in the zone, and in southeastern Pennsylvania, they're working with the Philadelphia Department of Health. But a provider's ability to perform this service in multiple regions and Commonwealth-wide and accept reimbursement rates closer to what the MA fee-for-service program was paying is a good option for the Medicaid managed care organizations. And some of the large-scale providers are also well-positioned to take on some of the higher volume, as I mentioned. And some are actually able to perform this service Commonwealth-wide. We have several of our managed care organizations and some of our children who move beyond regions from zone to zone, and having that consistency with a particular provider allows for continuity for that individual and the families. So I think, you know, in terms of the regional basis, I think there are lots of opportunities to still work with those providers, and some of our managed care organizations have actually reached out and have been able to make arrangements with those providers, but it's really on a case-by-case basis. And, you know, in terms of making sure that there is the access, that is part of the reason that we wanted to put this under the managed care organization's responsibility. We, as the state, oversee those MCOs to make sure that they are actually performing and allowing for the access in accordance with our agreements with those plans. So it's up to them then to make sure that children are actually getting those services across the Commonwealth.
Is there a way?
That's what we are looking at.
Secretary, is there a way to monitor that, though? That is one of the points that Brett brought up, that when this is contracted out, that, you know, he said he could actually file a right to know request if it was the state. But is there a way that it will be monitored and that the public will have access to, you know, what's going on?
Sure, sure. It's the same type of data that would be available under our fee-for-service program. We'll be able to collect the information on the number of environmental lead investigations completed for those children. I can say that in the fee-for-service program, there were not a lot of lead investigations being billed to the MA program. And so this will allow us the opportunity with our managed care organizations to collect that data, to share that. Hopefully we will start to see an increase in the number of environmental lead investigations being performed. I think what we've seen is under the Medicaid program, a lot of children receive the screening. It is a required component of their early periodic screening and diagnosis and treatment screen that they receive as young children. While the screening takes place, some of the environmental lead investigations and the referral process for those may not have been occurring because providers may not have known who to refer to if they were working with the managed care organization directly. Mm. And this was being performed under the fee-for-service program.
April Hutchison from the Department of Health, you wanted to add?
So I think one of the things that we're focusing in on is obviously the kids, and that's the most important thing.
And that is what my ultimate question is, would more kids be screened?
So the issue that there are two pieces that we're dealing with, and one is the children who are receiving benefits through CHIP and through the state who are eligible. To give you an idea, in 2017, you had 151,000 kids who are eligible of those, and this is age 0 to 23 months, of those 2,304 tests had levels above our 5 limit. So, but given that, it's still only 151,000 kids, and there are more than that in Pennsylvania. And so what we really, you know, we're looking at trying to make sure that we can provide remediation with limited funding, because obviously the federal government is where this money came from. And so what the Department of Human Services is trying to do now is continue to provide services through the existing systems so that they can continue to provide that remediation, because we have no new sources of funding to provide that.
How much did the feds cut back?
Well, it was a $2.9 million grant that just the Department of Health got. That was just through HUD. And then what we tried to do was supplement that with funding from the CDC. The CDC said, no, you can't use that money for this purpose. But bigger than that is all of the other children in Pennsylvania who are not receiving services through, you know, the CHIP program, that are on private insurance. It is an eligible benefit under your private insurance. Anybody can go and get their kid tested, but we need to be able to have universal testing to find out really the true extent. Is it one city who's being very aggressive in testing? Is it all over Pennsylvania? What extent? You know, we hear pockets in Philadelphia as well, the city of Philadelphia, it's in the soil. We hear pockets in, you know, Allegheny County. We need to really get a full perspective before we can start to talk about where this funding and reimbursement and getting into the nitty-gritty of all of that.
CHIP is Children's Health Insurance Program, and HUD, Housing and Urban Development. Let's take a call from Vinny in York. Vinny, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks so much, Scott. I'm the director of the Gladfelter Institute for Public Policy at York College. So for the last year and a half or so, I've been studying and working on lead in the city of York. I'm glad what I actually just heard, because I think that's exactly right. I don't think it's enough just to be testing children now, but we need to have that universal testing. But on top of that, we need to have strong public policies after that, ensure that children won't continue to be exposed to lead, and really minimize that exposure. Because what we're looking at right now in York is a very high percentage of children that are exposed and have elevated blood lead levels. But it's what comes after that. Because unless we can do something very productive and sustainable to ensure that they don't continue to be exposed, we're going to keep having these same health and education, these long-term these really negative long-term outcomes that we're not going to be able to do anything about.
Vinny, thank you very much for your call. He raises a great point. April Hutchison, what about that? What about the follow-up afterwards?
So I think it's really important that first, you know, a court, and Vinny's absolutely right, you know, Governor Wolf has called for universal testing so that we know what the true scope is. You can't begin to invest resources and determine where to put money and how to solve this problem for the long term without knowing the true scope. And so that's why the governor has called for universal testing of all children ages 2 and younger. We need to know what the true scope is. We have anecdotal information, but we need to know what it is beyond the children that we cover from the public system.
Look, I mean, if somebody comes into the emergency room with a broken leg, you don't say, hey, we got to figure out everybody else who might have a broken leg before we take care of this kid's broken leg. The thing is, I mean, while I agree that the data is partial and anecdotal and that better, you know, we need more data, we do know where a lot of this problem lies. And every one of these children, for every month, for every year that children remains exposed to lead, as Vinny said, those are effects that are going to impact them negatively for life. We know that this is something that if you don't put money towards it right away, you'll still end up putting money towards it later, unfortunately, because and April, I will certainly agree on this, I think, is that that lead exposure gives a lot of negative outcomes later in life, everything from lower employment standards and everything like that to increased crime rates in some cases.
Well, obviously, it's a big issue here in Pennsylvania, and I want to thank Brett Schultes, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, Lisa Allen, Executive Deputy Secretary, Pennsylvania Department of Human Services, and April Hutchison, Director of Communications, Pennsylvania Department of Health. Thank you very much for being with us today. Also, I should mention that Transforming Health, you can read more about this, see Brett's story, his report, by going to Transforming Health on WITF.org. Transforming Health is a project of WITF, Penn State Hershey, Penn State Health at Hershey, and also WellSpan Health.